Hello, welcome back to the Christian Leaders Institute World History Course 101. This is a course that examines the rise of human civilizations and human cultures. And in the first section, we covered a number of cultures from about 350 years before Christ until around the year 1000 before Christ. Today we begin section 2. And that is going to cover the time from 1,000 years B.C. until 500 A.D. That 1,500-year period is very important in the rise of human civilization. There is so much to be said, and we'll have to go really, really quickly. And unfortunately, we'll have to move over and not cover. Welcome. My name is Rich Hamstra, and it's my pleasure to be your speaker for this course. You will see that World History 101, in this section, we're going to cover these various civilizations: Persia, India, China, Peru, Mesoamerica, as well as the Mediterranean basin. They'll not all get equal coverage in terms of time. The Mediterranean basin is going to end up being a significant focus for us, but we'll certainly do our best with the other areas. We're going to start with Persia, and these are the primary areas that we're going to cover: Cyrus the Great, Darius, known as Darius I, and the Persian-Greek Wars of the 5th century before Christ. Here's your first reading assignment in section 2. It's the Achaemenid Empire, and the article is found online, written by Peter Davidson. If you're taking this course for credit, that is your assigned reading. Cool. So we begin with the person of Cyrus the Great. He's actually called Cyrus the Second, but we'll just call him Cyrus the Great. He was a tribal chieftain, basically down in southern, what today we would call southern Iraq, and in the ancient world was called Persia. But Cyrus was able to, through warfare in the most part, consolidate much of that Mesopotamian area. He took the Neo-Babylonian Empire that was crumbling. And you might remember in the first section we talked about that empire. Cyrus the Great was able to accumulate great influence and power, got the chieftains on his side, got the various leaders on his side, so that by 559 or so, or by 570, he began that, and by 559, he was really the ruler of all of Mesopotamia. That was a significant accomplishment. But then comes the real expansion of the Persian Empire under Cyrus, when he goes and has war with King Croesus, who is in Lydia. I'll show a map in just a second and point out these areas. That, with Croesus, that begins a long of conflict between East and West, between what is basically the Greco-Roman cultures and empires, and between the Eastern empires of Persia and what follows after that. There are significant differences in those two cultures, particularly when it comes to notions of what a good leader is and who the leader ought to be, and that is a theme that we'll be emphasizing throughout this course. Cyrus the Great was able to expand the Persian Empire at its greatest, all the way from the Indus Valley in India through the eastern shores of the Mediterranean Sea. So the Persian Empire is often thought of, at least in this region, as the first great international or multicultural empire. Here's a map of it. Coming around 540 BC, this is not the end of how the Persian Empire went, but you'll see here it goes all the way to the Indus Valley in India that he had control of. Here's really home base, this area, for the Persians, Persepolis and Ecbatana and Susa. Eventually, and we'll see under Darius I, they're able to control this entire area and also Egypt. As I mentioned, Cyrus, things changed dramatically. He was in charge of this area, but then when they had war with Croesus in Lydia, now, and they won, now the Persian Empire takes over Asia Minor, and they're right on the borders with Greece. Things become interconnected in history, and pretty soon we'll focus more on who the Greeks were and the development of their culture, but for right now, just we'll have to observe that the Greeks were already a significant seafaring power and trading power in the 5th century and 6th century BC. So this is the area that Cyrus controls, and he does that in fabulous ways. The gates of entering into the city of Susa, this is my wife Sue walking through here, this is in the British Museum in London. You pass through these large figures that demonstrate the power of Cyrus the king. So Cyrus was, as I said, significant in a lot of ways. But what he's remembered for in particular is he was one of the first, if not the first, emperor. He called himself King of Kings and Lord of Lords, who ruled vast areas and many different civilizations, many different groups. And the question becomes, how do you do that? Do you impose your own will and your own culture? Do you make them all like you? Or do you allow them to continue their local ways? Cyrus was one of the first who very purposely decided to allow people as much as possible, as long as they paid their tribute and their taxes to Cyrus and to the Persians, he allowed them to govern themselves in significant ways and to practice their own cultures and especially their own religions. You might remember that one of the tactics of the Babylonians was to take captives and bring them into Babylon and into their empire and put them in refugee camps, basically. The Israelites, for instance, taken from Jerusalem, captured and brought to the banks of the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. What Cyrus did when he came into control is he said, I am going to allow those people, I'm going to encourage them, as a matter of fact, if they would like to go back to their homelands and to go back to their ways. And I'm going to return to them a lot of the treasure that the Babylonians stole and allow them to rebuild their temples, rebuild their cities, repatriate. And as long as they pay their taxes and as long as they're loyal and they put their sons into service and his armies, then they could live as they wanted. This is new. This is new in human culture. And Cyrus is greatly remembered and greatly admired by many different. This is a typical Persian image, the winged griffin, the king, or perhaps one of the deities. This is an image of the Cyrus cylinder. This is housed at the British Museum in London. And it is a record, it's written in cuneiform, a record of Cyrus taking over the city of Babylon. This was done without shedding any blood. He went in and he replaced the person who was in charge of Babylon, basically by saying, I'm going to return to the old ways, especially the worship of their god Marduk. And the Babylon, the Cyrus cylinder records that Cyrus took over the Persian Empire by virtue of the god Marduk, and it also records his policy of repatriating people back to their homelands. The Bible in the Old Testament has knows a lot about Cyrus the Great. This is from the first chapter of Ezra, and particularly the books of Ezra and Nehemiah come out of this culture, come out of this time. And they remember that Cyrus was actually an agent of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is just a little bit out of 1st Ezra. This is how the book of Ezra begins. It has a notice from Cyrus himself. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, the king of Persia, to make a proclamation throughout his realm and to put it in writing. That cylinder that we saw is exactly that kind of writing. This is what Cyrus, king of Persia, says. The Lord, the God of heaven, and very typical of Cyrus, he was able to, he worshipped Marduk primarily, but he was able to give notice, he was able to give devotion to whatever God it was that he was talking about. The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth and has appointed me to build a temple for him at Jerusalem in Judah. Any one of his people among you, may his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem in Judah and build the temple of the Lord, the God of Israel, the God who is in Jerusalem. Very clearly, he thought of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as being very localized. He's the God of Jerusalem. He's not necessarily the God of Babylon. And the people of any place where survivors may now be living are to provide him with silver and gold, with goods and livestock, and with freewill offerings for the temple of God in Jerusalem. So Ezra indeed records for us exactly this political policy, this ruling policy of Cyrus. Cyrus is also mentioned prominently in, for instance, the book of Isaiah. And this is out of Isaiah chapter 45. Just the first three verses, but he comes up many times. You can check that out for yourself. Note what he says. This is what the Lord says to his anointed. Now that is the word Messiah. Cyrus is understood to be a Messiah, a Savior. That's pretty exalted language that comes out of the Old Testament. This is what the Lord says to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I take hold of to subdue nations before him, and to strip kings of their armor, to open doors before him so that gates will not be shut. I will go before you and will level the mountains. I will break down the gates of bronze, cut through the bars of iron. I will give you the treasures of darkness, riches stored in secret places, so that you may know that I am the Lord, the God of Israel, who summoned you by name. For the sake of Jacob, my servant, of Israel, my chosen, I summon you by name. So the book of Isaiah understands that this King Cyrus is God's Messiah, his anointed one. And he has come given in order to save particularly the Jews. The Jews in Jewish history have always had a very high opinion of Cyrus the Great. But of course, like all, he falls and he is succeeded by another one called Darius. There were a couple of in between. And in between, by the way, they take over Egypt. The Persian Empire takes over Egypt. But during the period of Darius I, Persia expands tremendously. And here's a reading assignment by Stephen Fife that you'll find online with regard to Darius the Great. Darius was in charge of the Persian Empire from 549 to 486 BC. At this point, he expands the empire to its largest extent. It's really considered the heyday of Persian power, of their cultural and institutional, economic, military, artistic He builds a new capital city, Persepolis, and he administers his empire by really is repeating something that we saw already in the Assyrian Empire, and that's been a few hundred years back in this period of time, where they divide their area that they're ruling into satraps, or into what we might call different states. And he puts a ruler in charge of that, but he also puts someone in charge, a separate person who takes care of the military. And this person is said to be the ears of the emperor in the satraps. So he plays a little bit of the governing power as opposed to the military power. Darius is well remembered. He was highly honored and highly respected by his people. He did begin to, because there is a revolt in Lydia. We saw that, remember on the map, we saw that, that's that western shores of Asia Minor, known to the Greeks as Ionia, and there is a revolt there. They're tired of paying the high taxes, and it's a tax revolt. So he sends his army, and the army just keeps conquering. They conquer, they go all the way through Lydia and Asia Minor, but they also cross into Europe and take over parts of Greece. Well, of course, this becomes a major conflict now between Greece and Persia. Persia is by all means the larger, stronger, more affluent, diverse empire. The Greeks are made up at this time of just a couple of city-states, more than a few, some city-states, with the prominent ones being Athens and Sparta down in the Peloponnesus. I want to spend a little bit of time on the contrasting view of kings between Persia and Greece. And one way to think of it is that the Greeks, when they talked about the Persians, and when they talked about how people had to address the emperor of the Persian Empire, the leader of the Persian Empire, they used the Greek word proskynesis, is the Greek word, and what it means is to grovel like a dog. So that if you came into the presence of the emperor, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, what you had to do was you had to lie flat on your stomach, your face down, and you had to grovel like a dog grovels. Now, if you've seen a dog coming before its master and it whimpers and it has its tail between its legs, that's what they thought people had to look like when they came in front of an emperor. The Greeks, on the other hand, understood that their leaders were leaders, but they were first among equals. And you did not bow and scrape. You didn't grovel like a dog in front of your leaders. The leaders of the Greek city-states, the generals and political leaders, we shouldn't have the notion that it was a democracy like a modern democracy, but we should understand that they were selected by at least the leading families and wealthier citizens. They did not claim that they were appointed by the gods. They didn't claim that they had authority to rule from heaven. They took their authority from being chosen by the people, and they were responsible to the people and to the folks who put them in power. That's very different notions of leadership. So in Greece and the West, the notion is that you are chosen by the people to lead them, to represent them, to lead their armies, but in the East, you are chosen by the gods, and the gods give you authority to virtually rule with complete power. Whatever you said happened, and you were treated like a god in flesh. It is not for nothing that in the New Testament, the word proskynesis which the Greeks use to grovel like a dog, is one of the more common words that's used for and translated as to worship. So in the East, they worshiped the emperor. In the West, they respected and followed, but they chose who their generals would be, who their political leaders would be, and those have been contrasting views of leadership between East and West in many ways that is still true today. I don't want to give the impression that the East has not had more democratic societies, it certainly has, nor that the West has always functioned in that way. Long periods of Western history in which it was ruled by autocrats. But the fundamental value, the heart of the culture, is very much shaped by this understanding of who a leader is and how a leader ought to be and the allegiance that we owe a leader. In many respects, this is part and parcel of the battle between the Greeks and Persians. So it seems to me worth spending a little bit of time. This is just a picture of the pillars that held up the gates. I think this is in Susa, one of the primary cities of the Persian Empire. It is massive and intimidating. Again, the architecture tells you when you come into the presence of the king, when you come into the presence of the emperor, you grovel like a dog. So this is Darius I Persia, you see, all the way now to securely to the Indus River in the east, but also into what we would call China today, and goes here into western Turkey, but they have also now taken control of much of the coastline of the Black Sea and even down into Greece. They control Egypt down into the Nile and as far as Cyrene in Libya. So it is a humongous empire under Darius I. I'd like to spend a couple of minutes just talking about the religion of Zoroastrianism, which is the official religion that Darius I brought to the Persian Empire. Again, Darius did not say that everybody had to practice Zoroastrianism, but that became the state religion rather than the worship of Marduk and some of the ancient gods. It's also important because it becomes a significant influence on the later religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So Zoroastrianism is started by a man named Zoroaster, many hundreds and hundreds of years before Darius I. It was practiced in the hill country, but brought into the mainstream under Darius' rule. It has a monotheism associated with it, although we have to be careful with that term. Its theology is not always so explicit to make it clear, but there does seem to be one chief god to whom all the other gods report, and one chief god who is supreme deity and does not have any rivals. That god's name is Ahura Mazda. In Zoroastrianism, it's understood that this world is in constant struggle between good and evil. Ahura Mazda is the god who created good, and to be on that god's side, you do good. The world is filled with angels and demons. And, there's sort of the old cliche that the demon sits on one side and the angel sits on another, and each whispers in the person's ear about what to do, and the person has to choose between good and evil. That's a pretty apt image, it seems to me, for how Zoroastrianism understands or understood the conflict within a person. There are always these influences to get one to do what's right and good, or to do what's wrong. Humans We are created specifically to be ethical agents. And in Zoroastrianism, our job is to be on the side of good and to work that out. And good is often understood as caring for your neighbor, loving other people. So it's an ethical religion, but people are always free to choose. And that freedom to choice to choose is very deep within Zoroastrianism. And that's one of the features that does indeed come up again in other religions. Zoroastrianism believed that history ran in a linear way, not the circular way that we saw more of Buddhism and Hinduism, but in a linear way, and that there will be a definitive end of the world, definitive struggle between good and evil, between the angels and the demons, that great battle that later gets reflected is in apocalyptic literature as Armageddon, or in the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's part of the War Scroll, where there is the fight between good and evil, but ultimately in Zoroastrianism, good does win. The ultimate reward for having an ethical life, for choosing what is good, and to have more good deeds than evil deeds, is that you receive eternal bliss. The word paradise, for instance, which I believe only actually occurs in the Bible once in the New Testament. One of the sayings of Jesus from the cross, where he tells the thief on the cross, "Today you will be with me in paradise." I do believe that's the only time it occurs in the Bible. That is a word that comes from the Zoroastrian religion. It is that beautiful place. It's like a Garden of Eden. It's a beautiful, verdant place, and that is one's eternal reward. So, and of course, there's punishment. The punishment of hell or Hades, where one death is not just the end of life, nor is it just a return, nor is it a place of shadows or the shades, Sheol, like it is in the Old Testament, but it is a place of punishment for one's bad deeds. You could probably sense already themes that reoccur in those other religions I mentioned. So Zoroastrianism becomes the official religion of Persia, and undoubtedly, particularly the Jewish people who lived in the Persian Empire, were acquainted with Zoroastrianism and strongly affected by it. And most scholars, at least those of the kind who see a lot of cultural influence in the Old Testament and New Testament, understand that Zoroastrianism has influence, particularly in that apocalyptic way in the Old Testament and New Testament. That in turn gets passed on to Islam. There was some conflict, religious conflict, during Darius's rule between Zoroastrianism and an older religion that was practiced particularly in Babylon by people called the Medes. That was one of the large groups that Cyrus actually overcame. But the Medes had practiced an older religion, probably associated with Marduk or maybe one of the sun gods. They were astrologers. They observed the heavens. And they were known as the Magi, or the magicians. We get the word magician from Magi. And they seem to represent a very high, very influential priestly caste that was at odds with some of the Zoroastrians. But it's important for us Christians to note that the wise men, the Magi that are reported to have seen the star of Jesus in the sky and to come and to find this king who was born are these Chaldeans or Magi from the Persian Empire. We're going to turn now a little bit to the specifics of the Greek and Persian wars. And here is your assigned reading, The Persian Wars by Mark Cartwright. My point in having you do these readings is not that you glean every detail. There are many details. But they should reinforce things that I'm saying as well as fill in lots of gaps of things that I'm skipping. So here is a map of the Persian Empire, and this is during the time of Darius. They control this area, orangish area. They have great influence over these other areas. And so you see there, the Persians are way down into the Greek peninsula. All that the Greeks are really controlling is this is called the Peloponnesus, this island, the island of Pelops, where Sparta is. Spartans thought of themselves as Peloponnesians. And here is Athens on the Attic Peninsula. But the rest is all under Persian control. So in 499, Darius puts down a tax revolt in Ionia, Western Asia Minor, and then sends his army over the Hellespont into Europe, overcomes Macedonia, Thrace, pushes to conquer all of Greece. He's had it with Greeks. He's had it with their rebellion. He's had it with their competition in the Mediterranean for trade. And so he's going to just overwhelm them. But he knows in order to do that, he has to conquer the city-states, particularly of Athens and Sparta. There's a major battle at a pass called Marathon, which you've probably heard about. That was in 490 BC. And at that battle, it's important that a smaller, very small Greek armies actually stop the invasion of the Persian armies. And you probably know the legend. I'm not sure it's really a lot more than that, but the legend of the runner who was sent from the battle after the battle was finished of Marathon, was sent to run the 27 miles or so from Marathon to Athens and spread the word that the Darius and his Persians had been defeated. Hence the origins, the legendary origins, at least, of the great Marathon run. About 10 years later, the next emperor, Darius, dies. And the next emperor, by the name of Xerxes, he decides that he is going to take over where Darius left off, and he sends his other army. The Persian armies did not leave Greece after the Battle of Marathon. They entrenched, they didn't attack, they didn't try to conquer, but they did not leave. And so Persian influence continued. In 480 BC, Xerxes decides that he's finally going to put an end to this battle. It's caused all sorts of problems. Plus, he needs the money. Egypt has revolted. They got tired of paying high taxes to the Persians, and he had spent a lot of money conquering them back again. So Xerxes needs the money, and he sends another army to conquer. The Battle of Thermopylae, a very famous one, was actually lost. But for the first time, the Spartans enter the war. They come to their aid of the Athenians, and they hold off the Persian army long enough for the Greek army to sort of regroup, to evacuate Athens, because they knew that Athens could not be held. And after the Battle of Thermopylae, where the 300 Spartans are all killed, the Persians come down, they invade and conquer Athens and actually burn it. So it's sacked. So now the Persians control virtually all of Greece except that island of the Peloponnesus. Later, in the fall of that year, in 480, there is a naval battle at a place called Salamis. And that naval battle was extraordinarily important because if the Persians had won, then there would be virtually no Western culture. It would all be Persian. And there was the only holdout were the Spartans and their armies. A much smaller navy of Greek warships, which were much smaller but much more maneuverable than the Persian fleet, and outmaneuvered, kind of got the Persians in a place where they couldn't turn their boats fast enough, and the Greek boats smashed into them, sunk them, and the Persian navy is defeated. This causes Xerxes to abandon the notion that he could conquer Greece, and he returns, although he does leave much of his army in Greece. Now, at the last battle, I'm going to mention Plataea. The Greek and Persian armies head off. They're pretty well evenly matched in terms of size, but the Greeks win because of superior armament and tactics in their hoplite soldiers. At that point, the Persians decide to give up their invasion of Greece, go back into Asia Minor, and the Greek culture, Greek civilization, particularly the city-states of Athens, which rebuilds, of Sparta, they begin to control that whole Aegean area. And the history of Greece comes out of that. In 499 BC, there's a peace treaty signed between Greece and Persia. And that is the conclusion of the Greek-Persian Wars. East and West. The cultural differences, the political differences, the differences in religion, those in philosophy and in leadership all hung in the balance in these years, basically 50 years of the Greek-Persian Wars. And because the Greeks held on and eventually the Persians retreated, we have East and West in very different ways. This map will just, again, I'm just going to point out some of the places I already mentioned. Here is the pass at Thermopylae, where the 300 Spartans held off the Persian invasion, at least for a little while. Here's Marathon, where the battle is won and Athens is spared for the moment. Here is Salamis, the naval battle, where the Greeks outmaneuvered the Persian fleet. And here is Plataea, where the final battle is fought between the armies. So the Greek-Persian Wars become a real turning point, at least in the Mediterranean basin, of how history will unfold. I think with that, we're going to leave right now. We'll just finish off a little bit of the Persian story and then move on. The Persian Empire is actually known officially, and they were known to themselves not as the Persian Empire, but as the Achaemenid Empire. That's because that was the clan that Cyrus was from. But that lasted another 200 years after Xerxes pulled his troops out of Europe and out of Greece. It went on, and the Book of Esther, for instance, in the Old Testament, comes from this period, I think. It was still a mighty and great empire and ruled huge vasts of area, but it turned inward and became more and more about palace intrigue. The story of Esther is very interesting historically in the sense that it tells us it's an illustration of palace politics and how things are done within the palace, and seems to be a very true reflection of how much the Persian Empire was decadent and was fallen. It held power in the area all the way until the time of Alexander the Great, who's going to be another one of these Greeks, in 334 BC, conquers and takes over the entire Persian Empire in basically just a few years. Quite astounding. And with that, we'll leave Persia for a while. We'll have to come back. Now I'd like to shift gears to ancient India. Basically the time in between 500 BC and 1000 AD. Again, 1500 years of important history in the foundations of a culture and of a country. And we're just having to skip so much. I hope you maybe are stimulated enough that you'll go back and check out more of the details. The fundamental theme of this time is that there's a real shift in cultural influence from the Indus Valley, which in section one of this course, the early years, we talked about that, to now the Ganges, which is on flows to the east. So we move from the west influence to the east. I think that actually we're going to just save this until our next session. Thank you very much for being here today. Hope to see you soon. God bless.